As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Monday, March 19th, 2012. Now I'd like to turn the conference over to Kevin Knobloch, President of UCS. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you so much, Eric, and welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for this hour for this critical discussion on nuclear reactor safety. We've had more than 1,000 people RSVP for this call and webinar, which we're very excited about, and we think is a testament to all of you who recognize how important the issue of nuclear power is as our country debates our energy future and as policymakers grapple with key issues of public safety and health, economic considerations, and, of course, the threat posed by climate change. As you likely know, the Union of Concerned Scientists has been a leading advocate for nuclear power safety and a leading organization with technical expertise on the various pieces around nuclear energy for decades. In the last year, since the Fukushima disaster, our experts have been in high demand, providing critical analysis and insight to the Congress, to state policymakers, to the public, and to the media. Of course, there is heightened concern as people question whether what happened at Fukushima could happen here in the United States, and what can be done to better protect the public from the inherent risks of nuclear power. So today, we will focus on those key safety and security questions, as well as on the economics of nuclear power, as state and federal policymakers debate questions related to new nuclear plant construction, to loan guarantees, and other issues that will have an impact likely on all of you and all of us as ratepayers and as taxpayers. Discussing nuclear safety will be Dave Lochbaum, who is the director of UCS's Nuclear Safety Project. Dave is a nuclear engineer by training who spent many years working in the nuclear industry. He is one of the nation's most highly regarded and respected nuclear safety experts. To discuss UCS's work on nuclear economics will be Ellen Venko, manager of UCS's Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project. A highly regarded energy policy expert, Ellen has more than 25 years of experience in the electric utility industry. Also joining us today is Sean Meyer, who helps manage UCS's nuclear power safety advocacy campaign. A veteran public interest organizer and communications professional, Sean will talk about the key goals and strategies of our campaign and how citizens like you can get involved. We expect our presentations to last roughly one half hour, leaving us a comparable amount of time for questions and answers. As Eric, our operator, mentioned, before the Q&A period, you will be again instructed on how to submit your questions, either via phone or via the web. And please know that if we don't get to your question, we encourage you to email the question to us at aquisol@ucsusa.org. Let me repeat that. aquisol@ucsusa.org. That's if you find yourself submitting a question and simply because of the press of questions we don't get to your particular one. So with that, let me turn it over to Dave Lochbaum.
Thank you, Kevin, and good afternoon, everybody. Last year's disaster at Fukushima involved a series of challenges that got progressively more severe. First, an earthquake disconnected the plant from its electrical grid. The normal supply of electricity to plant equipment was lost. As designed, the plant's emergency diesel generators automatically started and provided electrical power to vital equipment needed to cool the reactor cores. Three quarters of an hour later, a tsunami caused by the earthquake flooded the site and disabled the emergency diesel generators, taking away the backup source of electrical power. As designed, banks of batteries automatically took over to supply electrical power to a minimal subset of emergency equipment needed to cool the reactor cores. But the batteries were only designed to last for 8 hours, while the power outage lasted 9 days. With three layers of electrical power sources gone, workers scrambled to jury-rig a fourth layer using portable generators and portable pumps. The workers needed to reduce the pressure inside the reactor vessels and containment structures in order to use the small portable pumps to supply makeup cooling water. But the containment vent valves lacked power to function. By the time workers manually opened the containment vent valves, reduced the pressures, and supplied makeup water to the reactors, the damage had been done. Deprived of sufficient cooling water, three reactor cores overheated and melted, producing large amounts of hydrogen gas. This hydrogen gas found its way into the reactor buildings. Hydrogen explosions literally blew the roofs and upper walls away from the reactor buildings on units 1, 3, and 4. The explosions had the unintended benefit of creating pathways for helicopters and water cannons to supply makeup water to the spent fuel pools. It appears now that those efforts prevented extensive damage to the fuel stored in those locations. Over the ensuing year, workers restored closed-loop cooling for all six reactors and all seven spent fuel pools at Fukushima. Water treatment facilities were installed to clean up the water that collected in basements. Braces and supports were installed to protect structures damaged by the earthquake and explosions from collapsing. And panels are being erected around the damaged reactor buildings to limit the release of radioactivity into the air. Many years of costly cleanup activities lay ahead. Within weeks of the disaster, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, formed a task force to review the event and provide recommendations to make our reactors less vulnerable. The task force made 36 recommendations and sub-recommendations on three implementation pathways. The fast-tracked items, based on their urgency but also upon their not requiring further analysis, would be implemented by orders requiring plant owners to take certain steps within about 2 to 5 years. The second phase would implement upgrades via a public rulemaking process within about 5 to 10 years. And the third phase would entail research to evaluate the viability of certain measures, with actions being taken or not depending on the results of those studies. The NRC commissioners approved this plan, with orders being issued to plant owners just last week. Unfortunately, the commission seriously impaired the process by relegating the task force's primary recommendation to last place. In its 90-page report, the task force described how the NRC has two different methods for handling accident prevention and mitigation. For what are called design basis accidents, there's a very formal, rigid, and robust system intended to ensure with high reliability that workers and the public are protected in the event of such accidents. But for what are called beyond design basis accidents or severe accidents, there's a very informal and often voluntary system. The task force recommended that the NRC clarify regulatory requirements for severe accidents, not necessarily to make them identical to those governing design basis accidents, but to establish clear ground rules for plant owners to follow and NRC inspectors to enforce. The majority of the task force's recommendations involve measures to protect the American public from severe accidents like the one that crippled Fukushima. But by forging ahead on other task force recommendations without first clarifying the regulatory framework, the commission is dooming the effort to likely failure. For example, consider the severe accident management guidelines. Following the Three Mile Island accident in March of 1979, which was also a severe accident, the NRC sought better procedures for control room operators to respond to such events. So the NRC required plant owners to develop severe accident management guidelines. But the NRC did not require plant owners to do anything other than merely develop these guidelines. Last spring, after the Fukushima disaster, NRC inspectors audited the implementation status of the guidelines at every U.S. nuclear plant. All U.S. nuclear plants have the mandated guidelines, but the guidelines are not available in more than 10% of the control rooms. Workers never receive training on the guidelines at 8% of the plants, while workers are never retrained on them at 23% of the plants. Emergency exercises using these guidelines have never been conducted at 40% of the plants. And at more than half of the plants, the guidelines are not being updated to reflect modifications to the plant and revisions to plant procedures. For example, at the Watts Bar nuclear plant here in my state of Tennessee, the guidelines instruct the operators to use hydrogen recombiners to prevent a hydrogen explosion inside containment. But the hydrogen recombiners were physically removed from the plant several years ago. Thus, in event of a severe accident at a U.S. nuclear plant, the NRC expects workers to first find the guidelines, break them out of their shrink wrap, read through them, and flawlessly execute them without prior training under extremely stressful conditions. They might succeed, but they're basically being set up for failure. We agree with the task force. It is vital to clarify regulatory requirements governing severe accident measures. but by failing to do so, the NRC risks repeating the severe accident management guidelines folly. The nuclear industry intends to implement the task force recommendations via a plan that it calls FLEX, for flexible. From the limited details provided thus far, it appears that this plan follows the model used in response to the security upgrades ordered by the NRC after the 9/11 tragedy. Those upgrades included portable pumps and generators added to plant sites to allow workers to supply makeup cooling water to the reactor cores and spent fuel pools in event of suicide aircraft damage to the other sources. When NRC inspectors audited this equipment last spring after Fukushima, they identified numerous problems like the temporary equipment not being physically capable of being connected to water supplies or power sources. As with the severe accident management guidelines, the NRC required plant owners to obtain this equipment, but did not require any measures to make sure that this equipment might actually work. The NRC inspectors documented the severe accident management guidelines variability and also documented the inconsistent and sometimes ineffective implementation of the 9/11 security upgrades. The NRC's task force identified that these and other shortfalls were caused by the regulatory requirements for beyond design basis events not being clear. The NRC's task force recommended that these regulatory requirements first be clarified before the agency undertook the implementation of lessons learned from the accident at Fukushima. But the commission ignored or improperly dismissed findings by its own inspectors and the recommendations from its own task force and charted the same course that has failed time and again. It will likely fail this time, too, for the same reason it's failed so many times in the past. It's appalling that the commission treats lessons learnable from a nuclear disaster so nonchalantly. Protection of workers and the public should not be voluntary, should not be discretionary, should be mandatory. The NRC must clearly define what is required to protect against Fukushima-style events and then ensure that all U.S. nuclear plants, not merely 50% or 75% or even 90%, satisfy those requirements. The NRC must become an aggressive cop on the nuclear beat, not a beaten nuclear cop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. And Dave will be available along with the other speakers for questions when we get to the end of our presentations. Let me now turn the microphone over to Ellen Venko.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much, Kevin. I want to talk to our audience today about the outlook for nuclear reactors, new nuclear reactors in the United States. I don't know how many of you have been following the talk of the nuclear renaissance over the last five or so years, but before Fukushima, up until 3 years ago, the industry was predicting upwards of 30, 40 new reactors being built over the next decade or two. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission had more than 30 applications for new reactors. I know many of you can't see the slides I'm using, but we will provide them to our listeners via email after the presentation's over, so I apologize to those of you who don't have access to the presentation, but you will be able to obtain it later. And what we've seen in the last several years is that, and this is before Fukushima, is that out of the applications before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, five reviews have been suspended by the applicants. A number of others have not been formally suspended, but we don't expect them to go forward. And at present, only two units at one site have been approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for new construction, and one unit that was canceled years ago has been approved for reconstruction. But I'll run through what's actually getting built and then talk a little bit about why the industry is having such difficulty with its renaissance moving forward. The first reactor to get approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in decades is the Vogtle 3 and 4 units in Georgia. They only received approval this February And that was after the design these reactors are based on, the AP1000, was approved on December 30th of last year. So this is a very new development for the industry, and it's viewed as very positive by the industry. Vogtle's being built at an existing reactor site, and costs were estimated about $14 billion for the two reactors, but that is an estimate that was made in 2008, and we have seen reactor cost estimates escalate considerably since then. However, updated cost estimations have not been made for this facility, or I should say they have not been made public. The reactor is being built for several reasons. First of all, there's a lot of support for nuclear in the southeastern United States where this report is located. There's public support. There's a lot of political support. But the reactor is being built for other reasons as well. First of all, it's going to get an $8.3 billion loan guarantee from the federal government. It will have access to generous tax credits as a result of legislation passed by Congress. And it also will benefit from something called construction work in progress, or as we like to call it, CWIP, which means that the reactor builders can bill their customers for years in advance of these reactors ever being completed and generating electricity. The problem with CWIP that we see is that even if the reactors don't get built, the customers will pay for the costs incurred by the utility and will be assured of no refund if there's a cancellation later on. Another reason the reactor is going to get built is because it's owned by multiple owners, so the risk not only is spread among taxpayers and ratepayers, but it's also spread among several utilities. And one little fun fact for everybody is that I don't know how many people will recall, but Vogtle 1 and 2, the first two reactors at the site, ultimately cost $8.8 billion to complete, and that was a 1,200% increase over the original price tag of $660 million that those plants were supposed to cost. So we're all watching with great interest to see how much these plants will actually cost when and if they are completed. Now we get into the category of what could get built. That's the only plant that we can say is actually under construction as far as new build goes. There's something called DC Summer in South Carolina, and that plant is awaiting NRC approval, and we expect it will get it. It is also two reactors located at an existing site. Again, the company, the only cost information we have is almost $10 billion, but that's from 2008. That figure did not include financing and interconnection costs. So it's going to be much more than the $10 billion. We just not sure what that will be either. This facility is also expected to get a federal loan guarantee and generous tax credits for production. And then it also benefits from state construction work in progress. This plant only has two owners, South Carolina Electric and Gas and South Carolina Public Service Authority, also known as Santee Cooper. What's interesting is that 2 years ago, before Fukushima occurred, Santee Cooper said they wanted to cut their 45% stake down to like 10 or 15%, but they haven't found a buyer. So while it's expected that this plant will go forward, the fact that one of the two major partners wants to dramatically reduce their share in the project does raise some questions as to whether both units will get built or perhaps they'll only go forward with one. At this point, as I noted, it's not clear. Now that we get into the what might get finished, because we have a couple of leftover reactors hanging around from the 70s and 80s, the first one's at Watts Bar, owned by the Tennessee Valley Authority, and this is a reactor whose construction began in 1973. Two units were to be built at the site. The first one was completed in 1996, and it was the last reactor to come online in the United States from the first generation of reactors. TVA is now in the process of finishing a partially completed Unit 2. It was 80% complete when the construction was stopped in 1988, and so they're seeking to complete that plant. They've got approval from the NRC to do so. However, we received news reports in February from TVA saying that the project is now over budget and behind schedule. So yet again, it is unclear what the completed reactor will cost, and it is also unclear when it will be finished. But that is what TVA's commitment is. There's another set of TVA reactors that were also started and then halted in construction. These are about 38 years young. Construction also stopped in the 80s. At that point in time, $4 billion had been spent, and these reactors effectively became a scrap pile for and materials were reclaimed over the years. We don't really know what it will cost to complete them, but in 2010, TVA authorized almost $250 million to complete Unit 1, and in 2011, they began to move forward with building it. However, in the last several days, it was announced that hundreds of contractors were being laid off from the project, and TVA has recently announced that the project is effectively suspended, saying its ultimate cost and timing will depend on whether and when they complete Watts Bar 2. So that's pretty much the activity, those four sites that we've seen in terms of new reactor construction, if you can count restarting reactors that are almost 40 years old as new reactor construction, that's where we are today. But what happened to the nuclear renaissance? We heard a lot about it. It was moving forward. And quite a number of things happened. And that had nothing to do with Fukushima, although I wouldn't suggest that Fukushima didn't have an impact on the industry. First, we had a recession that resulted in declining demand for electricity on the part of consumers and industry. We saw continuously rising construction cost estimates. Natural gas prices declined. Renewable energy prices declined. We also didn't get a climate and energy bill, which would have put a price on carbon. And because nuclear power doesn't generate carbon, they would have benefited from restrictions on carbon-emitting fuels. Finally, the industry was also advocating for significant new subsidies over the past several years, both separately and as part of federal climate legislation. They didn't really get these. The subsidies they're getting now were passed in 2005, but they needed a lot more if their renaissance was going to move forward. And then finally, of course, Fukushima has had an impact. A number of companies, in my view, used Fukushima as a reason to get out of projects they had already decided they didn't want to complete. And it's most critical to the industry that natural gas, which had risen considerably over 2000, is now basically back to where it was in the year 2000. So the argument for nuclear power being needed to hedge against high-priced gas has gone away, at least for the time being. I just want to say again that nuclear cost estimates have continued to rise. Because we don't have a completed plant, nobody can say for any certainty what they will cost. And then, you know, then there's the question of, well, what's the rest of the world doing? Before Fukushima, nuclear power provided 30% of Japan's electricity supply, but only 2 out of 54 reactors are presently operating, and only 3 reactors were damaged during Fukushima, so the rest were taken down for maintenance and inspection. However, unlike the United States, local communities will get to decide in Japan whether they will reopen, but Japan is committed to a phase-out of nuclear power by the year 2050. They will relicense several reactors that are currently under construction on a case-by-case basis. They've announced that they will not issue new construction licenses, and overall their intent is to reduce their long-term dependence on nuclear power and increase their dependence on renewable energy and energy efficiency. That leaves the rest of the world, and of course the rest of the world is moving forward in various ways. China, the biggest developer of nuclear power, suspended approval of new reactors until they could complete inspections and develop new safety rules. However, it is expected they will restart their construction program this year. Germany shut down 8 older reactors and announced that they will shutter their entire fleet by 2023 and focus on efficiency and renewables. Switzerland, which also was expected to move forward with nuclear power, froze their expansion plans. Italy, which had reversed a previous moratorium, reimposed a moratorium on plans to reestablish a nuclear industry in that country. And France announced recently that their 58 reactors will be upgraded after a series of stress tests found a bunch of deficiencies that the nuclear regulator ordered the industry to correct. And finally, there are other countries moving forward. I don't want to suggest that they're not, but it is interesting to note that between 2008 and 2010, construction work began on 38 reactors around the world, but in 2011 to 2012, there were only two construction starts. So the industry, the effects of the industry worldwide of Fukushima continue to play out. And, of course, in this country, I would suggest that it's more natural gas than Fukushima. But I think that the four plants that I told you about, in my view, are the only ones likely to see construction, at least for the balance of this decade. I don't think anybody can tell you what will happen after 2020. That's all I've got. And if you have any questions, I look forward to answering them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ellen. And now I'll turn to Sean.
Thank you, Kevin. So I'm going to take a few minutes to talk about our nuclear power safety campaign. And let me start with what is a very clear goal. And our goal here at the Union of Concerned Scientists is to better protect public health and safety by improving the safety and security of the nation's 104 operating nuclear reactors. And UCS, of course, has been at this for some time, as both Kevin, Ellen, and Dave mentioned. But we really hope to seize the opportunity, if you will, that comes out of the horrible disaster of Fukushima 1 year ago. And with heightened public concern, we believe there is an opportunity to enact reforms, some of which we've been advocating for decades, such as dealing with spent fuel storage and better emergency planning and improved compliance with fire protection regulations and other things that Dave mentioned. So how do we do that? Well, first, we need to be very clear on who ultimately is responsible for nuclear safety, and that authority rests exclusively with the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission and those who oversee it, namely the Congress that funds the NRC and conducts oversight, and the President of the United States who appoints the commissioners. And the NRC, like many agencies, would probably prefer to operate in relative obscurity, and they really did so prior to Fukushima. And it's really after 9/11 and other major crises, such as Chernobyl and the Three Mile Island accident, that the public and policymaker attention increased. And as a result, there were some positive changes and reforms that came about after those incidents. So our job, really, with your help, is to keep the attention on the issue and on those responsible. In other words, we need to prevent the issue from fading away as people's attention moved on to the other things, like the November election or the next big crisis. And if the NRC knows that citizens and others are there to hold them accountable, they're more apt to do their job. So in looking at how to keep the pressure up, we asked ourselves, who has a stake in this issue, and who will the NRC, the Congress, and the President listen to? And we asked ourselves, who will have to deal with it if there is an accident? And the answer is citizens and local and state policymakers. And that would be your governors, state legislators, mayors, county commissioners, of course, emergency planning and public health officials in the event that there were an accident. It's really these folks who will be on the front lines, who have a clear stake in making sure that such an accident never occurs, and that if it does, constituents are as safe as they can be. So a major focus of our campaign is focused on reaching out to these policymakers at the state and local level to educate them, to engage them, and urge them to get involved in concrete ways to elevate safety issues, particularly those of specific concern to them and the citizens they represent. So really, for us to be successful, we're going to need your help. Your governor, your state legislators, and other leaders are oftentimes much more accessible to the average citizen than, say, the President of the United States or your member of Congress. Just as an example of the engagement that we're seeing with this call in this briefing, when you had the opportunity to RSVP for this call, hundreds of you requested what we are calling a citizen advocacy toolkit, and we're putting those toolkits together. And we sort of decided to go a bit old school with this and that. We have put together materials for you all that includes informative information. We've just released a number of new reports, so you have the information you need to discuss this issue with your policymakers. And it also includes different materials on tips for how to write a letter to the editor or suggested talking points for doing so. We'll include sample resolutions that you can then take to your members of your city council or to your mayor, to your state legislator, urging them to bring those resolutions up before their legislative bodies. And perhaps most importantly, what I'd like to emphasize in this briefing is that this campaign is really about engaging with as many of you as possible in tailored state-specific ways. And we very much are encouraging folks to be in contact with us as we invited you all to this call and briefing. We've included our email address, and we very much want to get a dialogue going with you about the concerns and issues that you're dealing with in your communities and get your suggestions on ways to keep the pressure on, if you will. And I'll just repeat what we said in the emails, that I mean that very much, that anyone on the call today can be in touch with me directly, and we can talk specifically about ways to work together. And my email is smeyer, M-E-Y-E-R, at ucsusa.org. So I think that before we open it up to Q&A, let me just mention that we see a real critical opportunity in the months ahead. As we all know, we're well into the election season already, and we see a tremendous opportunity both within congressional races and gubernatorial races and even the presidential election to continue to keep the issue of nuclear power safety alive. You'll have candidates in various forums in your own communities, and we certainly hope and would work with you all to take opportunities to attend those forums and ask those key questions about what those policymakers will or should be doing to make you safer. I should also just mention that we think that a key part of keeping the drumbeat going on the issue of nuclear power safety really requires a steady stream of media attention on the issue. The media, as we know, has a short attention span, and we very much hope to continue to engage with the editors and reporters at your local newspapers and your radio stations, and you oftentimes have greater resonance with them to say, this is of concern to me and my family, and to encourage them to keep covering the issue, particularly if you have a nearby plant. And certainly we hope that with editorialists, the opinion page editors of the paper, to continue to urge them to keep talking about this critical issue. Because really, again, the bottom line is we can't let the issue fade away. We're reminded of the rather significant decrease in attention after the Gulf oil spill. And, of course, people have many things to be concerned about, but our job working with you is to at least keep the issue in the minds of the people making these key safety decisions. And with that, I'll turn it back to Kevin.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Dave. Let's get into questions and discussion. Let me ask our operator, Eric, to repeat the instructions for how you can ask a question.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. Your line will then be accessed from the conference to obtain information. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question. And our first question comes from the line of Mark Klein. Please go ahead.
Yes. Recently there was a vent release of some steam at San Onofre. Can you explain that accident?
Thank you, Mark. Dave?
Yeah, this is Dave Lockbaum. About 5 weeks ago, one of the steam generator tubes, it turns out now several of the steam generator tubes at San Onofre Unit 3, developed a leak. The leakage rate was well below federal limits, but it was higher than the amount that allowed the plant to continue running. So the plant was shut down within hours. Workers have gone in and out pressure tested the tubes to find the ones that were leaking. Last week, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission sent a team out to San Onofre to see what the cause of that failure was, to see if it's isolated to just that plant or might have more broader implications. They'll also see what the plans are by the company to fix that problem to verify that it's sufficiently broad and is a true fix to the problem.
Thank you, Dave. Eric, we're going to alternate. We have between questions over the phone and questions online. We have a list of questions that have come across from listeners as well. So if you'll indulge me on that, we'll take a question. We've had several questions about storage of spent fuel rods. Question basically about what's the deal there, what can be done. Another one that was sent in advance is there a safe way to dispose of spent reactor fuel? And then also Alan Hurst online says most materials, I presume he means radioactive materials, are harmful in large quantities. Is it cost-effective to dispose of waste in the manner it is found or dispersed in small quantities? So, Dave, I wonder if you could give a response to this universe of questions.
I'll try to. The UCS for years has been recommending the accelerated transfer of spent fuel from the pools where it must initially be located after coming out of the reactor core into dry cask or dry storage on site. The fuel must stay in the pools for at least 5 years, but currently our pools are filled to almost overflowing. The accident in Japan, the spent fuel pools there had about as much fuel in the spent fuel pools as in the reactor core. The average spent fuel pool at U.S. reactors is 3 times that. Some of the spent fuel pools have 10 times as much fuel as is in the reactor core. The safety systems and the backups protecting the public from the spent wet pool storage is not too good. So we would recommend moving it from the pool storage into dry storage on site. Dry storage isn't perfectly safe, but it's significantly safer both from a safety standpoint and from a security standpoint. The dry casks are much less appealing targets for those who wish us harm. As far as the question about the volumes or the storage mechanisms, the fuel assembly, the fuel bundle, is the smallest component that's moved around at the plants routinely. That fuel bundles, those fuel bundles can be put into dry casks that can be stored on site for a while and then shipped off site to a repository or whatever the federal government deems to be the final location for that fuel. The one related topic is there's a number of plants around the United States that have permanently shut down, and the only hazard left at those sites is the spent fuel that's on site, whether it's in dry casks or in wet pools. There's been some talk, and the Blue Ribbon Commission released a report in January this year suggesting that perhaps centralized interim storage of the fuel from permanently shut down plants is appropriate. For the operating plants, the spent fuel is the least of the hazards available, so you don't get much bang for your dollar in moving spent fuel from those locations.
Thank you, Dave. Eric, we'll take a question from the phone.
Our next question comes from the line of Heidi Viertaler. Please go ahead.
Yes, there's been talk about the difference between fission and fusion in the past, about trying that there may actually be hope for an actual clean energy in the form of like one of the other of the fission or fusion, and I'm wondering if there's been any discussion and talk about that these days.
Dave, do you feel answering that? Or
yeah, I can take that one. About a few years ago, maybe 7-8 years ago, the Department of Energy hosted a 2-day workshop for non-government organizations, including UCS, to talk about fusion. And one of the things I was reminded in attending that workshop is that even the fusion reactors that they're envisioning are not clean. They generate quite a bit of radioactive waste, mainly in the systems that are used to confine the fusion, the plasma. And also the schedule, if they get all the funding they want and all the breakthroughs work as hoped, the first prototype reactor won't be available in 2047. I don't even know if that's the current schedule, but They would have been working on it for 100 years if they meet that schedule. And it seems like there's easier ways to get there. It's in concept right now. There's not really detailed plans, so it's hard for UCS to look at those sketchy details and say that that's a good thing or a bad thing because it's so vague at this moment. So one of the things we asked them was to more fully flesh out their design so we could look at it and see whether it's better or compare it to what we have today to see if it's a step forward, step backwards, or step sideways.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Heidi, for your question. Online we have a question from Marcy Mooser. I know that most citizens don't like footing the bill for new construction, but they feel insignificant in any attempt to reject or dispute it. Is there anything that citizens can do in response to QIP? And Ellen, I wonder if you would start with that and John can add in.
Yes, thank you, Kevin. QIP exists because it was legislated into existence due to pressure from nuclear utilities and sometimes for other purposes as well, but primarily for nuclear. And one of the things the industry learned from the first nuclear build in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s, was that they didn't want to get stuck with the costs and risks again. So the short answer is you need to go to your state legislatures and let them know that you don't want a process in place whereby the utility is assured of recovering the cost from ratepayers for very expensive and highly risky plants. And the states that are most likely where this is going to be an issue, of course, you have it in Florida, you have it in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Missouri is seeking to implement a law, and utilities in regulated states are seeking to implement it elsewhere. So the real action is at the governor's office and at the in the state house, because the public service commissions, once that law is passed, are under obligation to effectively approve those proposals, although they are also expected to review them for reasonableness. So there's an opportunity to participate there, although it's more difficult for the average citizen to participate at the Public Service Commission than to contact their state representatives.
Thank you, Alan. Eric, we'll take another question from the phone.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder to register a question, press 1-4.
Shall we go? We have a line of them online, so I can go there.
Yes, go ahead.
Brian Smith online asks, what is the most important lesson to be learned from Fukushima? Dave, and then Alan, if you'd like to add in, please.
Yeah, this is Dave. I think the most important thing I learned from Fukushima was the extended loss of power, where they lost the normal supply of power and the backup. That was considered to be such a low likelihood that the batteries that they have only were designed to last 8 hours. Most of the nuclear plants in the United States only have 4 hours worth of battery backups because it was just never really considered possible you get in that scenario. Our plants are susceptible to that, not necessarily from the earthquake tsunami 1-2 punch, but earthquake fire, or earthquake severe weather, tornado, hurricane, et cetera. So I think we need to provide the operators with options for dealing with problems on a sustained business, not just for only 4 hours, and then they're left with a lot of equipment they can't use. So if we can fix that problem, I think that'd be a big step forward.
And this is Ellen. And I think in addition to learning the technology and plant-specific risks and the site-specific risks that were present at this plant, those risks exist everywhere in different form, and we need to understand that when people say it can't happen here, it just means they haven't imagined what could happen here. We may not get a 50-foot tsunami, but we could get something else equally devastating. We just haven't imagined it yet. And the lesson, I think, for everybody especially is the fact that first responders are there, the firemen, the military, can get as disrupted by the event as the plant operators themselves. So the training, the preparation, the notice, the plans have to extend well beyond the boundaries of the nuclear plant itself.
Thank you. A question online from Darren Culp. FEMA has a radiological emergency preparedness program that seems to be required to work with the localities surrounding nuclear power plants to help them develop what the NRC calls off-site emergency preparedness plans. And FEMA is required to make determinations as to whether those off-site plans meet regulatory requirements and share that information with the NRC. In the case of any relicensing of a currently operating plant, is the NRC required to consider... Oh, hang on. Is the NRC required to consider off-site emergency preparedness plans or any assessments of such off-site plans the NRC receives from FEMA? It's a long question, but did you follow that, Dave?
Yes. The question is properly phrased. Every 2 years, federal regulations require an emergency exercise to be conducted at every U.S. nuclear power plant. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission comes in and evaluates how well the plant owner meets their responsibilities for actions within the plant's fences. The FEMA comes in and evaluates how well local, state, and federal authorities discharge their responsibilities outside of the fence boundaries for protecting the public from any potential releases. So in every 2 years, FEMA evaluates those entities and their performance and issues a report card back to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, either thumbs up or identifies some things that are okay, but some things that need to be fixed, or conceivably can fail a plant and require some remediation. About a year ago, the FEMA failed the authorities around a nuclear plant in New Jersey for some things that had not been done properly and gave them, I think, like a six-month probation period to get it fixed, and they'd come in and retest it. So that's an ongoing process. It's not revisited in license renewal because it's done every 2 years before and after license renewal.
Thank you, Dave. Eric, do you have a question in the queue?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Luann Kowar. Please go ahead.
Hello. I am wondering, and this would probably be for Mr. Lockbaum, there are so many short-term challenges and so much work that needs to be done to improve safety right now. Obviously, that has to be the short term, but I'm afraid that mid-term and long-term prospects are going to, for personnel to manage and implement both operations of existing facilities, safety protocols for existing facilities, and management of decommissioned ones. Is the engineering community going to be able to support this for 30 or 40 years out? And is the educational queue going to respond to that if all of a sudden the nuclear renaissance has sort of collapsed? And you know, we will finally get to renewables, then what will happen in the long term with managing the nuclear energy we have today?
That's a very good question, and we are seeing signs of that occurring already. As the existing workforce ages and approaches retirement, it's called brain drain. They take that knowledge and skills with them. Many companies and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have programs in place, configuration management and knowledge management, to try to capture that skills and that experience so that it doesn't walk out the door when people
mm-hmm.
retire or move
mm-hmm.
on. Mm-hmm. On the other side of that, a complication is that when I went through college, I have a degree in nuclear engineering. There were about 80 universities in the United States that offered nuclear engineering degrees. It's now down to less than half of that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not as many people being trained for nuclear power, and there's people leaving. So it is going to be a challenge.
Is that something that USC would try to keep in the press or highlight in the press too?
Well, the way we try to address that is have the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's performance assessment process be as effective and timely as possible. So if performance levels at nuclear power plants start to drop, whether it's due to brain drain and workers leaving or
mm-hmm.
it's due to insufficient resources for plant owners to maintain aging equipment or just bad management, whatever. We want that problem to be detected as soon as it can so that intervention can occur before safety margins are compromised. So we tend to focus on, you know, prevent those kind of problems by striving as hard as we can to make that, the NRC, what the NRC calls its reactor oversight process, as timely, efficient, and effective as it possibly can be.
Thank you.
Thank you. Question from Daniel Gilmore related to the total cost of nuclear energy, of nuclear reactors, relative to the cost of subsidies and waste disposal. Ellen, would you field that?
Yes, I would be glad to. UC has did a report that we released actually about 3 weeks before Fukushima called Nuclear Power Still Not Viable Without Subsidies. And that report provided great detail on both the historic and existing and future subsidies available to new reactors. And what we found was that in many instances, the value of the subsidies provided to the industry, and we calculated waste storage as part of this, exceeded the value of the power produced by those plants. And the new subsidies to reactors could follow the same trajectory. Right now, various cost estimates for nuclear range, you know, there's no one estimate, and one of the difficulties of actually estimating the cost is, since we haven't completed a reactor in this decade, there isn't anybody can tell you exactly what it will cost. We had a study that we released last year by Synapse Energy Economics, called Big Risks, Better Alternatives, and we estimate at the mid-range point, just looking at the Vogtle and Levy plants, that a new reactor, those plants will generate electricity at somewhere between $115 and $164 per megawatt. And last year as well, EIA, the Energy Information Administration, it issued an estimate at $114 a megawatt. So they were that sort of ties with our mid-range estimate for Vogtle. So it's interesting that you know, the cost ranges are right about the $115 mark, but that's for building a reactor at an existing plant. It's much more challenging, and it's going to be much more expensive to build a reactor at a new plant. But subsidies absolutely are essential to getting these reactors constructed.
Thank you very much, Alan. Let me mention that we have enough questions in the queue that we are willing to go 10 to 15 minutes past the hour if the interest remains. So if you haven't had a chance to get your question in, we'll go a bit longer. Eric, another question on the phone?
Our next question comes from the line of Gail Stamps. Please go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. Yes, I live in southwest Indiana, and first of all, I was wondering how close is the nearest nuclear plant to us? Also, we've had very active spring weather already, tornadoes and such. I'm sure you've heard on the news. So if we are within 50 to 100 miles of one of those reactors, how safe are we?
Dave?
I believe the closest reactor to your community would be the Callaway nuclear plant in eastern Missouri, but I have to check a map to be sure, but from memory, that seems to be the closest one. There are hazards living downwind of or downstream of a nuclear power plant. The closer you are, the higher those risks are. But Fukushima and Chernobyl all taught us that it also depends on the weather and the rain conditions. There were some spots 25 miles away from Fukushima that are more heavily contaminated than those 10 miles away. The one thing that protects you and people in America is the emergency plans I alluded to earlier. If there is a problem at a nuclear plant in the United States, there are emergency plans that are designed to evacuate or shelter those who might be in harm's way. So if that bad day does arrive, the authorities, I'd listen to whatever the authorities did, recommended, and follow those. I would strongly suggest or recommend against taking matters into one's own hands and evacuating if they don't recommend that, because you could end up driving right into harm's way instead of remaining in a safer place.
Also, can I just follow up a little bit? I'm also a visually impaired, disabled person, and so would we have special provisions for that as well? Would somebody, like, come and rescue me from my apartment, for instance, and take me somewhere?
There are measures like that in place for people who live within 10 miles of a nuclear power plant. They don't extend beyond that distance. But it, I think the safe thing is for your community, like my community here, which, and I'm outside of 10 miles, we can register with the local responders so they can, they'll work with us to make sure that the people in our community are protected. Those with special needs get special help so that that's done whether you live within 10 miles. It's mandated if you live within 10 miles, but it's frequently happens if you live outside.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your question. There's a couple questions sort of in this universe, Dave. Let me share them. Connie Hammond says, what is the status of earthquake stress reevaluations? Have recommendations been made yet for retrofitting existing plants? And then Merton Reynolds asks, how disastrous would it be if an earthquake broke open a spent fuel storage facility?
Well, the first question is, in the early 90s, the United States Geological Survey redefined the seismic hazard in the United States, and it mainly affected the central and eastern United States, where the hazard is now higher than it previously considered. When the Nuclear Regulatory Commission acted upon that information in 1996 to say that any new reactors built in the eastern United States would have to be protected against the upgraded seismic hazard. But at that time, they didn't do anything about the 27 reactors that were already operating in that area where the seismic hazard is now known to be greater than the protection for it. Because of Fukushima, the NRC is now requiring all plants in the entire United States to go back and revisit their flooding and their seismic protection levels against today's hazards, not the ones that necessarily were thought of 30, 40 years ago. That's going to take 2 to 5 years to complete that, both the walk-downs, the evaluations, and any ensuing upgrades that are identified. So it's while the 2 to 5 years might sound bad, the fact that it's happening rather than just being debated is the good news. The second question was what would happen if an earthquake opened up a spent fuel pool. That's the reason I'm at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I had a concern about spent fuel storage back in 1992. It is a problem because those structures that surround the spent fuel pools aren't really designed for that situation. There's so much radiated fuel in the spent fuel pools that a 1997 study by Brookhaven said that a spent fuel pool accident could harm as many people as the worst case reactor accident. So the consequences are comparable, but the protections are much less robust and reliable for spent fuel. So that goes back to one of our top key recommendations is to get that material out of the spent fuel pools and into dry casks where the risk is much better managed. So the sooner that can happen, the happier I'll be.
Thank you, Dave. Eric, question from your end?
Our next question comes on the line of Alex Canara. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thanks. I'm a longtime UCS supporter, and I've had some interesting conversation with Sean there recently, and actually got something from Ashley, which was forwarded. However, it seems to me that general philosophy seems to be against nuclear power in the future. You say keeping the 104 reactors that we have safe, and then, but not talking about do you oppose any new ones of any kind, for instance, ones that in fact don't have spent fuel and that sort. And the reason I'm bringing this up here, I'm wondering if you are aware of the 1962 report that President Kennedy requested and got that explained how we should be done with the kind of water-based reactors we have today by about 2000 and not be burning fossil fuels by 2000. I'm wondering if anybody here at ECS is aware of that report. And I'm also concerned that when we talk about QIP, helping nuclear power construction, do we actually compare that expense with the cost of the norm exemptions, naturally occurring radioactive material exemptions that coal plants and other combustion plants get, so that the EPA finds that we kill over 12,000 Americans per year from coal burning. Is that cost figured into the comparison with the benefits of nuclear power that doesn't produce that kind of emission?
Alex, thank you for your questions, and I'm going to turn to Dave on the thorium question and to Ellen on the cost comparison to coal question. But let me start by responding and acknowledging we at UCS have really from the beginning of our tackling of this issue back in the early 1970s been neither for nor against nuclear power. We've really made it a point to be objective and really, you know, from a technical perspective and more recently from an economic analysis, really try to help translate what some of the issues are around this energy source. In addition to your question, there was a question online from Bruce Scudd who said, I've been a member of UCS for 30 years. During this time, UCS has been agnostic about whether the U.S. uses nuclear power as an energy source, but only concerned that it has been used safely. Given the avalanche of UCS concern about both technical and regulatory aspects of nuclear power, how can it continue to remain neutral on its adoption? And, you know, both your point and Bruce's point are well taken. Our view has been we provide the biggest contribution by being an objective, watchdog in the sense of nuclear reactor safety and an objective analyst in terms of the overall picture of nuclear power as compared to other technologies and energy sources. Even though you could say that the balance of the body of our work is adds up to be quite a critique of the industry.
Well, that's fine. I give you money for that reason.
Well, good. Good.
But the fairness, it means that you got to keep up to date. So I'm wondering if you're aware of what was said in 1960.
No, I understand that. And okay. let me turn to Dave and then to Ellen.
Before we turn to Dave, Alex, I just also wanted to mention that one of the upcoming pieces that we have in our work plan, I don't know what the exact time frame of this is that we expect to be producing a backgrounder on the issue of next generation technology. That will really be, if you recall back in 2007, we produced a report called Nuclear Power in a Warming World, and there was a chapter on next generation technology, and we do very much plan to revisit that question, and undoubtedly some of your questions related to thorium reactors will be explored there. So I sort of urge you to hang tight, and certainly within the next 6 to 9 months that report will be forthcoming. But with that, Dave, I don't know if you have anything to add specifically related to the thorium question.
Well, I'm not pretty specifically talking about thorium. I'm just talking about improved reactor systems. That's all. And the point I'm trying to make is that even the Swiss, in 1998 report, which you probably read, found that nuclear power around the world was the safest form of energy production, including Chernobyl, which, of course, Chernobyl, you know, and of course you should make sure that all UCS supporters know, is a kind of reactor that no one else in the world ever built but the Russians, because it's inherently unstable. So it has no bearing on our nuclear power systems the way we have them now.
Dave,
so I'm just trying to say that you know, we talk about costs of current nukes and subsidies and so forth, but we don't seem to be talking about the exemptions. A coal plant can emit 100 times the radioactivity that a nuclear plant can. Coal ash, which piles around all over the United States, has more uranium in it than typical ores. So, you know, it's we have to be fair about what we tell people so that they can make a decision to call their legislator or whatever, you know, as we were talking before. And if we're not fair in how we assign costs to existing systems, then, you know, we're just going to be as misleading as the Koch brothers will be.
Well, this is Ellen Vanko. I think I can address that. First of all, we are UCS has a very large focus on coal. We have we just issued a report 3 months ago, or maybe it was 4 months ago, but outlining the considerable health costs and risks associated with continued burning of fossil fuels. So we are attacking that very directly. You know, we're not getting in, we haven't gotten into an issue of trying to do body counts of various technologies. Obviously, every technology has an impact. But I think to suggest that just because we couldn't count bodies in the streets and the plant, around the plants of Fukushima doesn't mean there wasn't an enormous and incalculable human impact from that single incident. That, to my knowledge, outweighs any other man-made or combination of man-made and natural disasters we have ever experienced. They're looking at $200+ billion in cleanup costs, people and communities completely destroyed, livelihoods destroyed, 100,000 people who may never be able to return home, a percentage, I think it was 6% of the Japan countryside that may not be inhabitable for several generations. So I think when we're talking about safety and nuclear safety in particular, we have to remember that the black swan events that generate these kind of outstanding impacts may occur rarely, but when they do occur, they have very significant impact.
Well, let me just make a statement that I have a friend who was a GE safety engineer at Fukushima when it was being built. And it was built without taking cognizance of things that GE told them. They would listen, they would take notes, they would go off, and then they would do what TEPCO management said. So Fukushima, as well as the tsunami event, is really a governmental problem. It's not a nuclear power problem in Japan. It's the way they operated. They allowed people to build factories and houses and plants in a tsunami zone that was known to be a tsunami zone. I mean, if you've read the various articles about that, even the New Yorker had an article last October about it. There are these stone tablets written by their ancestors 200 or 300, 400 years ago that say, don't build here. And the reason they say don't build here is because, as geologists found out and warned the Japanese government years ago, there have been tsunamis there regularly. So to say that this is a black swan event is ridiculous. It isn't. It's purely a bureaucratic event. It's in fact
Alex,
what you should be arguing against.
Alex, just Kevin, excuse me. We're gonna take this offline so we can get in another question or two. But
I mean, I just don't want to let people think that we've got this huge nuclear disaster when what we actually have in Japan is a huge. We killed 18,000 people, not nuclear. We didn't kill 18,000 or 20,000. They don't even know how many people have died.
Right.
They were
right.
Killed by nuclear.
Well, thank you, Alex. Let me. We may have time for one, maybe two more. Let me. Off the web, Christopher Thomas asks, what is the difference between design basis events versus other events? Does design basis just mean events that the industry thinks it is reasonable to plan for? Dave?
Design basis events are not the industry's take, although they had input into it. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission established what it conceived to be credible events that might occur during a plant's lifetime. There are things like a broken pipe, which drains water out of the reactor vessel most rapidly, or an inadvertent start of a system that injects, causes power to go up uncontrollably, failure of the control rod system to shut down the reactor when necessary. Those type of things are all design basis events. When the NRC issues a license, they look at those events, look at the design features that have been proposed for the facility, to see if the public will be protected if those postulated events occurred. Beyond that, design basis events are more severe events or things that are not considered credible. For example, an asteroid hitting a plant, that's something that no plants are designed for. It might happen, but no plants are necessarily designed to be protected against that. If you look at Fukushima, that plant was designed for an earthquake. That plant was designed for a tsunami. That plant was designed for the loss of normal power and backup power. But it wasn't designed for events as severe as that particular earthquake or as challenging as that height of the tsunami wave or for a station blackout or loss of power lasting for longer than 8 hours. So those conditions made it beyond design basis into something that it wasn't designed for, and it didn't luck didn't hold out.
Thank you, Dave. We're going to go to the last question off the web. Ann Anderson asks, what are your three biggest concerns about nuclear U.S. nuclear plants? And Dave, if you would start, and Alan, if you would like.
Kind of the old real estate question. It's NRC, NRC, NRC. if the NRC were an effective regulator, I'd be out of a job or I'd be in a different job, and I'd welcome that. Nothing against GCS, but I'd welcome that unselfishly for the country. The NRC is very good at establishing safety regulations. They're not so good at enforcing those regulations. As a consequence, many of our reactors have a lot of pre-existing deficiencies that are just waiting for a perfect storm to exploit them. If we don't have that perfect storm, if we don't have the challenge, then those deficiencies, you know, luck protects the public. But we need to have a better Nuclear Regulatory Commission, more effective, aggressive Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so the public gets all the protection it demands. Even with the NRC doing all that it can, the risk of a nuclear power problem isn't zero. But when the NRC doesn't do its job, that risk is unacceptably high.
Thank you so much. Deb, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ella.
I'm sorry. And just to add to that, for me, when we look at building new plants and look at what the costs of building those new plants are likely to be, the tension between cost containment and management's desire to maximize profits versus the need to maximize public protection, there's always going to be a conflict. It's not unique to the nuclear industry. It's unique to every industry where there's possible hazards posed by the technology. And as we saw in the BP oil spill, as we've seen in existing plants around the country, efforts to save money and cut corners in order to cut costs does put the public at danger, and that just underscores what Dave said, is that if we don't have an independent and an effective and thorough regulator, the public will be at risk, both from existing plants as well as new ones.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Sean. Let me bring this call to a close. The interest in this call has been really terrific, and we're unable to get to all of the questions, especially the ones coming online, maybe some on the telephone. And so I wanted to repeat what I said at the outset, that if you email your question to aquisol@ucsusa.org, we will do our best to get you a response. And really to reiterate Sean's invitation to get involved in our nuclear reactor safety campaign, if this is a concern of yours, we think it's really a critical effort. 120 million Americans live within 50 miles of an existing reactor. We believe from our years of experience and our analysis that many of those reactors can and should be run in a safer way, and that the true lessons of Fukushima have not yet been fully applied here in the United States and really must. So you play a critical role in the success of that campaign, of our ability to meet those goals, and we would invite you to either stay in touch with Sean or be in touch with Sean Meyer, and be part of that campaign. So thank you all so much for spending this hour plus with us, and we look forward to the next conversation. Thank you.